Any member failed to vote, would the clerk please announce the total?
24 members present.
Today, Father Peter Gorgeous will again lead the invocation. Would you please rise?
Let us pray. O Lord our God, bless us again today. Fill this chamber with the power of your Spirit. We are convinced that together you have given us every gift that we need to accomplish the perfect will for Alaska. Give us now the ability to work with each other, respecting the different gifts that are manifested in this chamber. Let the committee work and the work on the floor of this chamber be such that every man and woman will fulfill the potential that you have given them. Let the light of your truth so shine that the legislation passed by this session may adequately justify and satisfy the longings of your people. Amen.
Mr. Ellis, will you lead us in the pledge?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Mr. Martin?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to move and ask unanimous consent to play a brief pledge on the journal.
Is there objection? Hearing no objection, so ordered. Would the clerk please certify as to the correctness of the journal for the previous day?
As Chief Clerk, I certify as to the correctness of the journal for the third day.
Mr. Majority Leader?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move and ask unanimous consent that the journal for the third day be approved as certified.
Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Are there guests to be introduced today? Mr. Foster?
Thank you. I have in Gallery B, John Rip, a good friend of mine, a fellow Vietnam veteran with over 200 combat assault helicopter missions in Vietnam. John?
Mr. Grusendorf?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Speaker. The trial period is over, and at this time I'd like to introduce the Sergeant of Arms, Andy Mack from Soldotna, the Assistant Sergeant of Arms, Chris Casperson from Juneau, and with the permission of the body and the Speaker, I would like to ask the Sergeant of Arms to introduce the rest of the floor staff.
Mr. Mack, you have the floor.
Thank you. I'll introduce pages. I think one is gone right now. Yeah, they go do a run. So starting over here, this is Stephanie Samansky. She's from the Eagle River area. And in the back of the chambers is Roald Helgeson on your right. He's from Sitka. In between is Christy Jackson. She's from Kodiak. And on the left in the back is Morgan Stein from Wasilla. And on the left over here is Liam Westcott from Fairbanks. The missing page is Monica Charles from Bethel. She's about Christy's height, dark hair. So you'll see her around.
Mr. Boucher? I'll introduce Gia Verratti, who's in Gallery A, who's a page going to be working out of the Speaker's office this year. A constituent of Representative Barnes and Furness. Are there other guests? Are there messages from the Governor?
I have none, Mr. Speaker.
From the other House?
Mr. Speaker, the Senate accepts the House invitation to meet in joint session at 11 a.m. on the following dates. January 17 for an address by U.S. Senator Ted Stevens, and January 18 for an address by U.S. Senator Frank Murkowski. The Senate has approved the following citation and has been transmitted to Legislative Affairs for enrolling, honoring Chief Walter R. McGannick, Sr. The Senate has passed the following and is transmitted for consideration. Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 19 by Senators Binkley, Kelly, Zemanski, Fisher, Coghill, Eliason, Frank, Jones, Ewing, Fakes, Duncan, Porchot, Halford, Rohde, Pierce, Jaroff, and Sturgiluski, relating to alcohol and drug education programs.
Oh, that'll be referred to the Hess Committee.
I have no further messages from the Senate, Mr. Speaker.
Are there other communications?
I have none, Mr. Speaker.
Are there reports of standing committees?
There are none, Mr. Speaker.
Special committees?
No, Mr. Speaker.
Introduction of citations and resolutions?
I have none, Mr. Speaker.
Introduction of House bills?
House Bill 413 by Representative Larson, an act relating to civil liability for injuries or death resulting from equine activities.
Be referred to the Labor and Commerce and Judiciary Committees.
I have no further bills for introduction, Mr. Speaker.
Brings us to today's calendar. There aren't any citations on today's calendar either, so there is no calendar. Unfinished business? Announcements? Mr. Majority Leader?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I've been asked to make an announcement tonight. There's a reception hosted by Lottery Alaska Incorporated and the Iditarod Trail Committee Incorporated, and it's a reception for legislators. It's in the Treadwell Room of the Baranoff Hotel from 5 to 7 p.m. tonight, and Libby Riddles, the first woman Iditarod champion, will be there along with Rosemary Phillips, the executive director of the Iditarod Trail Committee, and that's from 5 to 7, so you could stop by before the governor's State of the Budget address tonight. Also, I'll announce now, and I'll announce again next week, the governor's annual legislative reception for both legislators and spouses at the governor's house on the 16th of this month at 5 p.m.
We stand at ease, please. Mr. Majority Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. There will be a House Majority Caucus in the Speaker's chambers upon recess this morning.
Mr. Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. There'll be a minority caucus over in the court building immediately following the recess.
I think everyone knows that tonight at 7 o'clock the governor will give his budget address, so we'll be try to be here at 6:45. Mr. Jacko.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. There'll be a House Foreign Trade and Senate Committee on Foreign Trade will hold a briefing today at 2 o'clock in the House Transportation Room, C-17 downstairs, to hear from Mr. Pierre Fellanius.
Yes, Pierre Fellanius.
Pierre Fellanius. Commissioner of Finland. So I'd like to, it's open for everyone to come and to listen. I think it should be really interesting.
Are there other announcements? Special orders, Mr. Majority Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move that the House stand in recess until 6:45 this evening.
We're in recess till 6:45. In order. In accordance with the Uniform Rules, Rule 51, at a joint session, the presiding officer is the President of the Senate. Mr. President.
Joint session will come to order. The budget message by the Honorable Steve Cooper, Governor of the State of Alaska, is in order. Will the clerk please take the roll of the House and Senate?
Members of the House, please register their presence by voting.
Will the clerk please call the roll of the Senate?
Senator Adams.
Here.
Senator Binkley. Excuse me, call. Senator Coghill.
Here.
Senator Duncan.
Here.
Senator Eliason. Senator Fairkamp.
Here.
Senator Bates. Senator Fisher. Excuse me, call. Senator Frank.
Here.
Senator Halford.
Here.
Senator Jones.
Here.
Senator Petula. Excuse me, call. Senator Pierce. Excuse me, call. Senator Pershaw.
Here.
Senator Rohde.
Present.
Senator Sturzelowski.
Here.
Senator Szymanski.
Here.
Senator Gulling.
Here.
Senator Jarrah. Senator Kelly.
Here.
13 members present.
It is again my pleasure to introduce the First Lady of Alaska, Michael Cooper. And Lieutenant Governor Stephen McAlpine and his wife Dana. And also the House of Representatives First Lady, Martha Cotton. Will Representative Boucher and Senator Frank please escort Governor Cooper to joint session? Session will stand at ease.
President Kelly, Speaker Cotton, members of the 16th Alaska Legislature, special guests, and fellow Alaskans. Tonight I propose to you a balanced budget for fiscal year 1991. Based on information that we have today, the revenue projections should allow your budget deliberations to be free of the stress caused by the perception of a fiscal crisis. Furthermore, revenues for the next 5 years appear to be sufficient to carry the state budget with very modest increases without the necessity of an income tax or any other major additional revenue source. Litigation now pending over back taxes and royalties are not factored in, but will almost certainly result in substantial additional revenue. Relatively speaking, the near-term prospects for budget stability in Alaska are pretty good. So I want to take this opportunity to make some comments on the Alaska state budget process. These comments are observations, nothing further. First, almost every elected official comes to Juneau with two conflicting sets of instructions. One set of instructions says to reduce overall spending, and the other says to increase spending or at least avoid reductions in each constituent part of the budget. In Alaska, very few organizations claim to speak for the general interest, but many speak for the interests of their own group. For example, I've never heard any Alaska business or economic development organization call for a reduction in capital spending or in programs designed to promote or otherwise assist business. Likewise, I've never heard an association of healthcare providers call for a reduction in Medicaid or other medical payments made by the state. The results of these conflicting messages are easily predictable. In politics, the specific drives out the general. Each of the vested interests represented in the state budget can be expected to take action to defend its turf and to enlarge it if possible. This is particularly true of entitlements, which represent over 47% of general fund spending. In terms of budget politics, the only common agenda is the sum total of all the many individual agendas. There has been talk of the need for long-term budget reduction for years, but it is hard to say with any certainty when those permanent reductions have to be made or how much has to go. Although token cuts are sometimes made, as was the case last year, in practice, state revenues are so unstable that both the executive and legislative branches have adopted the practice of managing as responsibly as possible from one year to the next. As an example, let me cite the events of only 3 years ago. At this time in 1987, budget deliberations began in an atmosphere of barely controlled panic. Oil prices had gone down so far that a cumulative budget deficit of $875 million seemed likely. The alarm bells went off. This administration proposed a 27% reduction from the budget authorized in 1986. In addition, an assortment of taxes were proposed. A mighty army of citizen advocates and professional lobbyists prepared to do battle. This was the big one. But oil prices refused to do what had been predicted for them. They would not behave. As the legislative session ground on, the oil prices rose so quickly that major changes were not necessary to balance the books. We thought we had reached the fabled day of reckoning, but it was just a false alarm. Now, that experience does not encourage the kind of radical budget reductions being proposed by some of the more strident organized groups. Budget figures may seem abstract, but services and benefits are not. They are real, and they affect the lives of real people. Theoretically, a radical reduction in government services and benefits could be made today. Large amounts of surplus revenues could be put aside for the future. It would be interesting to know how many people in this room would like to go to any group, particularly one that furnished political support, and say to them, in effect, I have helped to reduce or eliminate a public service that you have come to depend on in order to create a budget surplus that can be used later on to fund somebody else's benefits. In terms of the dynamics of state budget process, most people don't want to rock the boat until revenues actually fall. No one knows when that day will be with any certainty. As a political result, the status quo seems to commend itself in the absence of compelling reasons to change it. In stark contrast to 1987, the apparent situation this year suggests that neither major reductions nor major taxes will be necessary until 1995 or later. Not only do the current projections show that we'll have enough money to pay the bills for the next 5 years, we will almost certainly receive a substantial amount of additional money from the litigation now pending over back taxes and royalties. And of course, in the meantime, oil prices could rise more rapidly than the projections, although I don't think that's very likely. The exploration and development of the ANWR could be approved by the Congress, and there could be another Prudhoe Bay up there. For that matter, the Congress could decide to divide oil and gas revenues from the outer continental shelf with the states in order to create some political support to counteract the objections to offshore leasing in the lower 48. In the past, we have staked out ground only to discover later that the ground had moved out from under us. Given the conditions that prevail in Alaska, the most practical and realistic way to handle budgeting is to do it in the context of a 5-year plan which is reviewed every year as circumstances change. There's a bill before you that would accomplish just that. I urge you to pass this legislation. In addition, Alaska should have a budget reserve of 1/4 to 1/3 of the total general fund budget, so that sudden events will not force such abrupt reductions that economic chaos would result. We can probably use some of the litigation revenues for the budget reserve, or we can utilize the permanent funds reserve account for that purpose, but we should do it. None of this is likely to satisfy the various anti-government groups around the state, nor is it likely to pacify some members of the oil industry, which have enlisted their employees and contractors in an effort to get rid of as much government as possible for fear the industry will have to pay for it later on. Suffice it to say that for the moment at least, their views do not represent anything like a majority in Alaska. Now, I don't take issue with the many Alaskans who think government should get a moderate reduction just like everybody else did, at least in the rail belt. The only logical way to do that is to eliminate programs and reduce entitlements and to try to make the burdens fall as equitably as possible so that nobody is allowed to claim a special exempt status. If you want to initiate a serious effort at program elimination and benefit reduction, my administration once again stands ready to work with you to undertake this task. You are the people who write the budget every year, and your active participation is necessary for any major reductions that are made in this budget. For fiscal year 1991, I am submitting to you an appropriations bill calling for a general fund operating budget of $2.3 billion. The proposed budget represents an increase of 3.2% over the previous year. $106 million in additional spending was required of us either by changes in federal law or by formula-based entitlement programs to which the state has chosen to commit itself. Had these increases not been mandated, this budget would have been lower than the one which was approved last year. Specifically, the Public School Foundation appropriation will have to be increased by over $37 million due to enrollment increases, a decrease in assessed property values in the Rail Belt, and a decrease in the amount of federal money under Public Law 874, which provides revenue in lieu of taxes on federal property. Medicaid and public assistance will cost an additional $38 million due to increased utilization, sharply increased medical costs, and the automatic cost of living increases mandated by state law for recipients of public assistance checks. Changes in benefits made mandatory at the federal level account for a substantial portion of this increase. The federal government's new welfare reform legislation requires not only an additional $4 million in Medicaid and public assistance benefits, but over $2 million in child care assistance and $3 million for other programs such as child support enforcement and public assistance eligibility determinations. An additional $6.6 million was appropriated from the mental health trust account for mental health purposes. Last year, the legislature funded the longevity bonus for only 11 months. Picking up the 12th month will cost $6 million, plus another $3.4 million for the increased caseload. In addition, there are oil spill litigation expenses to pay, plus the cost of reapportionment and the 1990 elections. Aside from the required increments, some $22 million was added for law enforcement, the Pioneer Homes, road maintenance, environmental monitoring and enforcement, and other needed improvements and services. Included also in that figure is an additional $3.7 million for education over and above the required formula increases. This new funding will provide needed educational research through the University of Alaska, so that we can find out what teaching techniques produce the best results for at-risk youth. There is a token $1 million increase in support for Head Start. If mandatory increases had not been so high this year, I would have recommended more for Head Start. And this year we're initiating for the first time a small grant incentive program, which is designed to encourage the teaching of science and of Asian languages, including Russian, in Alaska's schools. For some years now, citizens in the areas served by the Alaska Marine Highway System have advocated a separate authority for the management of our state ferries. While I do not think an authority is necessary or desirable at this time, I am submitting legislation which would authorize the system to receive and expend all the money it generates during the fiscal year. At present, all the marine highway revenues go into the general fund from which its operating expenses are appropriated. There is little institutional incentive for the managers of the system to try to increase revenues. While the program receipts approach is not a cure-all, it should lead, at a minimum, to better service for the communities served by our state ferries. We are delaying the introduction of a capital budget until we have a little more specific information on the extent of corrosion on the Trans-Alaska pipeline system. But I can tell you that our capital proposals will emphasize maintenance of state-owned facilities, including our transportation system and the buildings on the various campuses of the University of Alaska. All over the state, maintenance of public facilities has been deferred for too many years. The logical extension of this neglect is the physical deterioration of those facilities, which will ultimately have to be replaced at enormous expense. Maintenance doesn't have much box office value politically, but it is necessary for reasons of health and safety, employee productivity, and ultimate cost. A moment ago, I mentioned the problem of pipeline corrosion, which could have a substantial negative impact on revenues during the next fiscal year and beyond. Major repairs of the pipeline were begun at Attigan Pass in 1989. About 9 miles of pipe will have to be replaced next summer near Attigan. Other sections of the line are affected by this corrosion as well. The TAPS operators are still assessing which areas need to be repaired. They plan to excavate in several places along the line in order to find out. The cost of pipeline replacement will be recovered through the TAPS tariff. This reduces the wellhead value of the oil and therefore state revenues. Assuming a likely repair bill of $200 million per year for 3 or 4 years, that's a reduction of $30 to $35 million more than has already been built into the FY91 revenue forecast, and at least $60 to $70 million for each year beyond 1991. We will report to you in detail on this matter within the next 60 days or sooner if we get the appropriate information. And as soon as the revenue implications of the pipeline repairs are a little more clear, we will introduce a capital budget. Now, I believe all of you have been furnished with a revenue sources book from the Department of Revenue. It's a good piece of work. It's brief, it's well indexed, and it's clear. I hope you take the opportunity to read it. Assuming the department's projected mid-case scenario prevails over the next fiscal year, our total available general fund revenues will be $2.44 billion. However, the experience we have gained over the past several years reminds us that random and unforeseen events can change the revenue outlook very quickly. The practice of planning our state budget over a more extended time period will allow us to better accommodate this built-in instability. The 5-year fiscal projection with which you have been furnished shows that we can sustain a very modest level of increases, about 2% per year after 1992, without adopting major revenue measures until fiscal year 1995. As I mentioned earlier, a major change was made from last year's 5-year plan in that we did not include revenues from back tax or royalty litigation, although we confidently expect to recover substantial sums from that source over the next 5 years. Last year, I proposed that we utilize at least some of the balance of the Rail Belt Energy Fund for the purpose of investing in the Rail Belt economy. Let me provide a specific example. Last year, the federal government and private companies spent over $80 million in Alaska on scientific research, exclusive of research that was done as a result of the oil spill. Because of a renewed interest in global environmental issues, it is likely that research funding in Alaska will increase very quickly. But research cannot be done without laboratory space. While university facilities fill that need in other states, the University of Alaska's research labs are tiny and inadequate. If we don't invest in these laboratory facilities, the research will be done at the University of Washington, or Oregon State, or the University of Colorado, or other institutions located elsewhere. I urge you to utilize a portion of the Rail Belt Energy Fund for the construction of the combined laboratory classroom buildings proposed by the University of Alaska in Anchorage and in Fairbanks. It could help us take advantage of a renewed national commitment to scientific research. Other practical uses of the Rail Belt Fund include infrastructure for resource development, winter tourism facilities, and build-ready airport sites. Since some areas of the Rail Belt will find uses for the investment fund quicker than others, a geographically equitable method of dividing the funds must be adopted. Since this is my last budget address to you, I would like to point out two long-term trends that could jeopardize our fiscal stability in the future. Both are national problems, and both must be addressed at a national as well as a state level. The first is the dramatic increase in medical costs. Over the past 5 years, the costs of health-related services provided by the state have increased from $190 million to $390 million in 5 years. These costs include, but are not limited to, state employee health benefits, Medicaid, public health and nursing services, and mental health programs, including the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. The escalating price of medical care in Alaska threatens not only our entire health care system, but all other state-funded services as well, because the added medical bills crowd out other competing demands. None of us would like to retreat to the days of yesteryear, when medical services in Alaska were minimal. But it is clear that state government can no longer afford a continuation of these sharply rising costs. The second problem is the civil justice system. The volume of civil cases and the cost of litigation have increased at an alarming rate in the recent past. The state has very few options in its efforts to cope with these increases. If we don't hire the lawyers and pay the expense of litigation, we lose the cases. To borrow a phrase from the late Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, the American civil justice system has become in many ways a brooding omnipresence in the sky, which creates massive uncertainties and unassessable risks. Medical costs and practices are affected by the fear of malpractice suits, as is the practice of law itself. Our legal system, especially in Alaska, is based on sound principles of justice. Generally, everybody gets treated fairly in the courtroom. But over the years, we have gotten increasingly adversarial as a people. All of us need to work to find a way to settle our disputes more rationally, as is done in every other nation. In the meantime, our legal costs in Alaska continue to mount. With these caveats, I wish you every success in sorting out this year's version of the Great Alaska Money Puzzle. Our dependence on oil revenues is risky, but over the years, we have developed an ability to cope with many of the resultant uncertainties. My administration stands ready to assist you in your deliberations. Thank you and good night.
Joint session, please stand at ease while the room empties. The joint session will come back to order. Senator Coghill.
Mr. President, I move the committee substitute for Senate Bill number 10, Finances Amended, relating to the deadline for action on funding of public education and providing for effective date, become law, notwithstanding the governor's veto.
There is an objection. Senator Coghill.
Mr. President, the bill which we're talking about is a bill that requires, it doesn't require an appropriation. The legislature may appropriate. That has to be in accordance with the Constitution. But the local governments throughout the state, and I, Mr. President, circulated a memo today to all of the legislators which stated that the attached memo from the Mat-Su Borough Assembly, which took the lead in asking that this particular piece of legislation be enacted, and notwithstanding the governor's veto. Last year, in the closing time of the session, we passed this bill on the House side, 35 votes for a yay, no votes nay. There were five absent. On the Senate side, Mr. President, it was passed with 18 yeas, no nays, and two were excused. Our constituents, Mr. President, need this piece of legislation. They need it because we have a mechanism in our educational process, which is a constitutional provision, that allows for most of the money to flow through the state. And so the boroughs and the school districts and the REAAs are very dependent on what we do here on the legislative floors as to the appropriation. And this was the reason for the early funding. And the early funding we established was in March. And we changed that to April to meet the concerns of the legislature as to the funding level as far as the fiscal note was concerned, or the fiscal condition of the state on April 1. And I agreed to that, and we went forward with it. And it was unanimously passed by the legislature. The governor, in his veto message, stated that we put too much on the agenda. In fact, I could read you his veto message. Although I support the idea of early funding of the foundation formula, as in my Senate Bill 143, I cannot support such a far-ranging set of early appropriation requirements as presented in this bill. Such a broad-scale approach would prevent placing these appropriations in context of the entire state spending plan, which could be detrimental to the state's fiscal planning and long-term fiscal stability. I don't think that this is necessarily a concern, Mr. President, from the standpoint that the legislature, by constitutional mandate, is the appropriating arm of government. And if they see fit to under-appropriate for the school foundation or for the transportation, or that short fund the appropriation for reimbursement of debt service, that that's a cause for the legislative debate. And I think that we should go forward with it, because then we have a mechanism, and this mechanism is for the people that are out there on the front line, Mr. President. Our power within government, ours being the House and the Senate collectively, is the purse string. That's the way that we control not only the philosophy of government, but also as to what goes on. And I think that we should own up to our responsibility, and that we should put the educational process on the agenda early, that we should pass a funding mechanism for the school foundation and for those things that go forward on it. And for that reason, Mr. President, I stand before the joint session and asking that the bill be passed, notwithstanding the governor's veto. And Mr. President, I know that you took a roll call at the beginning of the session, and I'm not too sure, but what maybe that I should ask then, that now that that the roll confirming that there's a quorum present on the floor of both houses.
Will the clerk please call the roll of both houses?
Members of the House, please indicate their presence by voting.
There are 36 members present.
Please call the roll of the Senate.
Senator Binkley, excuse my call. Senator Coghill.
Here.
Senator Duncan.
Here.
Senator Eliason. Senator Fearnkamp.
Here.
Senator Fakes.
Here.
Senator Fisher, excuse. Senator Frank.
Here.
Senator Helford.
Here.
Senator Jones.
Here.
Senator Curtula, excuse my call. Senator Pierce, excuse my call. Senator Pershaw.
Here.
Senator Rohde.
Present.
Senator Strzelczyk.
Here.
Senator Szymanski. Senator Euling.
Here.
Senator Jara, excuse my call. Senator Adams.
Here.
Senator Kelly.
Here.
Thirteen members present.
Madam Clerk, I believe Senator Szymanski is in presence. Could you call his name again?
Senator Szymanski.
Here.
14 members present.
14 members present. There is a quorum in both bodies. Representative Furness.
Thank you, Mr. President. I appreciate an opportunity to rise in support of the Senator from Fairbanks' motion today. Mr. President, I'm sure all members of this body realize that there are some 105,000 students within the school system in Alaska. It's only fitting that this body take positive action and acknowledge that large and growing body of students within our system. Mr. President, the governor tonight acknowledged that he was submitting a balanced budget. And for the first time in many years, he was submitting a budget that was absent the pressures of shortfalls. He also indicated that there should be sufficient funds based upon their best calculation to support the budget with minor adjustments over the next 5 years. The legislation before us this evening, Mr. President, will permit this body to approve the education budget early so that districts throughout the state of Alaska can prepare their budgets in time to meet the statutory deadlines. Mr. President, I believe conditions have changed. When the governor vetoed this legislation some time ago, we did not have the certainty of funding. According to the governor tonight, that certainty of funding is there. Mr. President, one of the chief responsibilities of this legislative body, constitutionally, is to make provisions for education. I believe tonight that it is proper that we override the veto and that a vote be taken tonight on this floor. We all deserve to see at least an up or down vote on the legislation. Mr. President, in closing, let me again say, conditions are changing. Our student population statewide is growing. School districts over a period of time have documented some $80 million in shortfall based upon adjustments within this legislative body. We have an opportunity today to at least make history by at least making an additional commitment of some type of a deadline, some type of a timeline, so that educational facilities, school districts throughout the state will at least know by March, I believe March 15th in the legislation, that the funds will be there, that they can set their budgets, and they can get on with the business of educating the students.
Senator Jones.
Thank you, Mr. President. I rise in support of the motion. This legislature sits here as an extension of the public. We represent every man, woman, child in our districts. I think every one of us, when we voted on this bill originally, knew that education is the number one priority back in our districts. I think those people deserve better treatment in that area. As mentioned before, the Constitution of this state places the responsibility of furnishing the opportunity for education every child in this state. It places that responsibility on the backs of the legislature. In this bill, we have said we want to put the dollars out there early so the best job possible can be put forth by our school boards and our local governments. Those school boards, if you follow the chain of command, the chain of responsibility, those school boards are actually an arm of this legislature. They represent us in those school districts. They represent our responsibility. They're the ones making those decisions back home. And we sit here, and deliberate over this budget,
and wait till the last day, practically, to let it out, those people are struggling with their own budgets. They're trying to put together what will be the education for our children next year. We are interfering with that process if we do not put this money, these dollars, out there early. We made the decision to put it out early. We made the right decision. Every one of us. There wasn't, as I recall, a nay vote. And yet, a person sitting somewhere else negates that responsibility, our responsibility. We're saying we want to put forth dollars to take care of education today, to next year, and the next year. Not 10 years from now, not 20 years from now, in some other fashion. We're willing to put our mouth out of the money out there right away. We're willing to do that. We've said it. We said we're willing to put that responsibility on. Someone else is saying no. I say tonight's our opportunity to turn that around and again override that decision, and again, without a nay vote, put the dollars where we meant them to be at the right time. Thank you.
Senator Alford.
Thank you, Mr. President. There is a lot of talk about support for education, but the budget just presented shortfalls debt service by something in the neighborhood of $20 million. We've met here in joint session before to override vetoes in debt service for education. Education is number one from the general fund. It should be taken up in number one order from the general fund. It is not properly used as an excuse to raise permanent fund income. We can do it. We have done it in the past. In 1988, we funded education first. It didn't create any catastrophe. It worked. We can do it every year, and we can do it right from the general fund. I strongly encourage every member to vote their own conscience on this issue as they did on the floor when the bill was originally before us.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. President. I think we need to look closer at the substance of the bill. All we have done in this legislation is set sanctions upon ourselves. In the same manner in which we pass rules to govern ourselves, we have said the legislature shall appropriate funds to school district under this section within a certain period of time. These are in-house rules, in essence. I think it's, aside from the good arguments raised regarding the purpose for having such an in-house rule for the convenience of the public and also for the benefit of the community so that they will know what the funding level is going to be and know it early on. This is our House and Senate rules, the legislature's rules, that we have set up and said we shall act within a given period of time. I think if for no other reason, it is totally inappropriate for the executive branch to tell us what rules we should or should not place upon ourselves. The executive branch always has the option, once this legislation had passed, if in fact the legislature acted promptly and did early fund education, the executive branch would always have the option of vetoing it, and we, being in session, would have the opportunity to override that veto and thus have finality in the bargaining process, if you will, between the legislature and the executive branch over the level of funding for education. Mr. Speaker, I have some additional remarks, but I would like to call for a brief recess that I might address the chair.
Joint session will stand in recess.
Out to the members of this joint session that nothing changes if we pass this bill. We have the ability to pass early funding of education whether or not this bill is in place. Might also remind you that the veto power of the governor doesn't end if we pass this bill. And if the governor has strong objections, and he indicated that he did by vetoing this bill, that will not change by us passing overriding his veto. He still has the right to veto any appropriation we make. Mr. Speaker, with that, I would move that the joint session stand in adjournment.
Mr. Speaker.
There is an objection. Senator Coghill, state your point of order.
Chairman, Mr. President, I state a point of order that you cannot recess under a constitutional mandate to take up a veto in the next 5 days after the session, the second session of the legislature starts. And I would like to call your attention to Article 2, Section 16 of the Constitution. Bills vetoed after adjournment of the first regular session of the legislature shall be reconsidered by the legislature sitting as one body no later than the fifth day of the next regular or special session of the legislature. And I say that the motion is out of order.
Senator Rohde.
Constitutional grounds.
Senator Rohde.
In response to my distinguished colleague's constitutional argument, Mr. President, the motion is in order. This Section 16 is not an absolute constitutional admonition. Some years we've had them, some years we haven't, most years we have not had veto override sessions. A motion to adjourn would be an indication by this legislature that it does not wish to enter into a veto session. Furthermore, I would point out the Supreme Court has never held that this section is mandatory.
Mr. President, I disagree with my distinguished colleague from downtown Anchorage. The rules that are set by the joint session or the joint bodies of the House and the Senate are constitutionally mandated. And the veto instructions within the Constitution, and Mr. President, I, if anybody else, would know that because I was there. And the reason why we did that in the Constitution was to prevent pocket vetoes. And Mr. President, on that, I call the House.
There is a call of the joint session. The session will stand at ease.
I'm sure we don't vote for the return.
Mr. President, in order to facilitate the debate on the main issue, I'll lift the call. I'll remove my call of the joint session.
Call is removed. Debate on the point of order is allowable. Is there any debate
on the point of order, Mr. Speaker?
Senator, Representative Taylor.
There's no debate on a point of order, Mr. Speaker. A ruling is required at this time.
Question.
In that case, I'll make a ruling on the point of order. And while I don't personally agree with the motion to adjourn, a motion to adjourn takes precedence over all other motions and may be made after the previous question has been ordered, but before a vote has commenced. Legislative bodies have the right to adjourn whenever they determine to do so, and that's in Mason's Manual, Section 200 through 204. It has been a long-standing practice of the legislature not to take up every veto, and the Supreme Court has not held that it is mandatory upon the legislature to take up every veto, and other legislatures have adjourned out from other vetoes. Even if it is mandatory to take up every veto, it is not mandatory that this be done at this session. Another session could be called for this purpose prior to the constitutionally mandated five-day limit. The motion to adjourn does not cut this right off. Therefore, I will rule that if a majority of the members in attendance wish to adjourn prior to voting on vetoed bills, that adjournment motion is in order, that the adjournment motion is not debatable, and that the clerk should call the roll on the motion to adjourn.
Point of information.
I appeal the ruling of the chair, Mr. Speaker.
There is an appeal to the ruling of the chair that is not debatable, the question being. Shall the decision of the chair stand as the judgment of this joint session? Will the clerk please call the roll?
No.
Got a member outside here.
Captain?
Yes.
Senator Lyason? Senator Farringham?
Yes.
Senator Bates?
Yes.
Senator Fisher is excused. Senator Frank?
Yes.
Senator Halpern?
No.
Senator Jones?
Yes.
Senator Petula, excuse. Senator Pierce, excuse. Senator Rochelle?
Yes.
Senator Rohde?
Yes.
Senator Sturdivant?
Yes.
Senator Zelansky?
Yes.
Senator Ewing?
Yes.
Senator Jaroff, excuse. Senator Adams?
No.
Senator Dinkley, excuse. Senator Kelly?
Yes. Members of the House may proceed to vote. The question is, shall the ruling of the chair be upheld? Members may proceed to vote. Clerk, please announce the total.
22 yeas, 14 nays.
So what is the total of the joint session, Madam Clerk?
33 yeas, 17 nays.
33 yeas, 17 nays.
So the decision of the chair has been sustained, therefore the motion to adjourn is in order. The clerk should call the roll.
Mr. President.
Objection. Point of information.
Mr. President, I move to amend the motion.
A motion to adjourn is not debatable. Will the clerk call the
roll? Mr. President, it is amendable. Mr. President, I move to amend the motion to 11 a.m. tomorrow morning, Mr. President.
Point of order. For the joint session, please stand at ease. We've got to offer the members an opportunity to change the vote. A motion to amend, a motion of adjournment is in order. Representative Barnes.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Excuse me, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move to amend the adjournment motion that the joint session reconvene at 11 a.m. tomorrow morning.
There is an objection.
Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker.
Representative Taylor.
I move to amend the amendment to 11:05 tomorrow morning.
That's out of order. There is an amendment to the amendment, but it would simply be simpler if you would withdraw your amendment to the amendment. You would withdraw your amendment and replace it. Representative Taylor.
I would ask unanimous consent.
Objection.
Thank you.
Representative Taylor, is there an objection to Representative Taylor, would you withdraw your amendment to the amendment, please?
Attempted to, sir, and there was objection to it. So apparently there are people that are interested in 11:05 tomorrow, just as I am.
Objection is removed. Therefore, we have an amendment to the motion to adjourn to 11 o'clock tomorrow morning. Did you wish to maintain that, or did you wish to withdraw that and make it 11:05?
Mr. President, I see no problem whatsoever with the amendment to the amendment because it is in order, and I don't see why, because once the amendment to the amendment is voted upon, it would carry the main motion.
What we have right now is an amendment to the motion to adjourn. At
yes,
11
Mr.
o'clock
President.
Tomorrow morning.
Mr. President, I have not withdrawn my amendment. I don't know what we're discussing.
I'm under the impression you did withdraw your amendment.
No, I did not.
Yes, you did, and the objection was repealed. So what we have now is a motion to amend the motion to adjourn until 11 o'clock tomorrow morning. Now, is there going to be debate on the motion to amend? Representative Barnes.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, if I may have the floor to discuss the purposes, and I think my motion was very clear. It was not a motion to simply adjourn. It was a motion to adjourn to a specific time for a specific joint session. And I do want the members of this body.
State your point of order, Representative Navarre.
Mr. President, I don't believe a motion to adjourn is debatable. She's.
I will rule, Representative Navarre, that the motion to amend the motion of adjournment is, in fact, debatable. Representative Barnes, continue.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I would like the members of this body to have an opportunity to give some thought to the seriousness of this matter overnight, and that we have an opportunity to come back refreshed in the morning, knowing fully well that we have not just one bill, but two that we're constitutionally mandated to take up in a joint session. And I've read many lawyers' opinions in the past that said that we didn't have to pay attention to this or that, and to me that's simply one attorney's opinion. And ask many different attorneys, you'll get many different opinions. So I do believe that we have a constitutionally mandated...
State your point.
Thank you, Mr. President. I don't understand how this remark relates to supporting the motion for 1105.
The motion is debatable as to time. Would you please restrict your comments as to the time, sir?
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I am attempting to restrict my comments to the time certain, and my purpose is for making it a time certain, and I believe my purpose is for relates to the motion, so therefore I was trying my best to keep it on the subject of the time certain. Mr. President, unlike some, my colleagues are not about to rattle me so they can yell all they'd like. Mr. President, I think this is very serious. I do indeed want this body to have an opportunity to think on the seriousness of taking up these vetoes at a time certain. And with that, thank you for the privilege, Mr. President.
Here. Representative Martin.
Mr. Speaker, I want to follow the order of the presiding officer. And so before I vote on this question, I would like to know, because I had assumed from your answer before that it was the intent that perhaps on Friday there would be a joint session to address these bills. And from your written comment, it sounds to me like Friday was available to us and that you needed more time one way or the other. So I would like to know, sir, on the point of information, did you intend for us to have a joint session for the sole purpose of overriding the governor's vetoes of bills? And if so, is that the intent? Because I'd really like to follow the Constitution, which is the people. No, it's not our Constitution. It's not the governor's Constitution. It's the people's Constitution.
Thank you. Concerning your point of information, Representative Martin, I hadn't given a great deal of thought to whether or not we should have a joint session tomorrow. What I was pointing out was that under the Constitution, the five-day limit didn't run out until tomorrow. So it would be possible to leave here this evening without having taken action on veto bills and come in again tomorrow. That was my only point for your information. Now, what we have here is a motion to amend the main motion of adjournment to 11 o'clock tomorrow morning. Perhaps we should vote on that.
Question.
The question being, shall the motion to amend the motion of adjournment until 11 a.m. pass the joint Senate? Would the House proceed to vote?
President, I ask unanimous consent. Procedural motion.
There is an objection. Would the House proceed to vote?
I have to ask if any member wishes to change.
Does any member wish to change his or her vote?
Yeas, 22 nays.
Would the roll call of the Senate be called, please?
Senator Duncan?
No.
Senator Eliason? Senator Fahrenkamp?
No.
Senator Fakes?
Yes.
Senator Fisher excused. Senator Frank?
Yes.
Senator Helford?
Yes.
Senator Jones?
Yes.
Senator Katula excused. Senator Pierce excused. Senator Prochot?
No.
Senator Rohde?
No.
Senator Strugulewski?
Yes.
Senator Zemanski?
No.
Senator Ewing?
Yes.
Senator Zhuroff excused. Senator Adams?
Yes.
Senator Binkley excused. Senator Coghill?
Yes.
Senator Kelly?
Yes.
Nine yeas, and 5 nays, for a total of 23 yeas and 27 nays.
So the motion to amend the motion of adjournment until 11:30 tomorrow morning fails. That brings us to the main motion to adjourn.
Wait.
It is not debatable. Senator Halford. Joint session is
nine.
No,
we're back in order. Will the joint session come back to order? We have in front of us a motion to adjourn.
Mr. President.
The joint session, the motion is non-debatable.
Senator
Rohde.
Mr. President.
The question has been called for.
Roll call
vote. Will the secretary please call the roll of the Senate?
Senator Lyson. Senator Fahrenkamp.
Yes.
Senator Page.
No.
Senator Fisher excused. Senator Frank.
No.
Senator Halford.
No.
Senator Jones.
No.
Senator Petrilla excused. Senator Pierce excused. Senator Porchot.
Yes.
Senator Rohde.
Yes.
Senator Sturgiewski.
No.
Senator Zemanski.
Yes.
Senator Ewing.
No.
Senator Jarrah excused. Senator Adams.
No.
Senator Binkley excused. Senator Coghill.
No.
Senator Duncan.
Yes.
Senator Kelly.
No.
Yeas, 9 nays.
Would the House please vote?
Yeas, 11 nays.
Does any member of the Senate?
22 yeas.
Does any member of the Senate or House of Representatives wish to change his or her vote? Would the clerk, the secretary, please tally the vote?
27 to 20.
Would the secretary please tally the vote? If you don't vote, it's your problem.
27 yeas and 20 nays.
No. What is the vote total?
27 yeas and 20 nays.
27.
The vote is 27 to 20 to adjourn. The joint session is adjourned.
Tomorrow morning.
Is there objection or no objection? We're adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow.